my talk this morning is on the third precept. I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct. With stillness, simplicity, and contentment, I purify my body. So I'm going to start by reading you two poems, both of which express stillness, simplicity, and contentment, but in quite different ways. So the first is by Ryokan, and the second is by D.H. Lawrence. So firstly, Ryokan. My hut lies in the middle of a dense forest. Every year, the green ivy grows longer. No news of the affairs of men, only the occasional song of a woodcutter. The sun shines and I mend my robe. When the moon comes out, I read Buddhist poems. I have nothing to report, my friends. If you want to find the meaning, stop chasing after so many things. So D.H. Lawrence. When she rises in the morning, I linger to watch her. She spreads the bathcloth underneath the window, and the sunbeams catch her, glistening white on the shoulders. While down her sides the mellow golden shadow glows as she stoops to the sponge, and her swung breasts sway like full-blown yellow Gloire de Dijon roses. She drips herself with water, and her shoulders glisten as silver. They crumple up like wet and falling roses, and I listen for the sluicing of their rain-dishevelled petals. In the window, full sunlight concentrates her golden shadow, fold on fold, until it glows as mellow as the glory roses. So, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And the expression of sexual love can be such a beautiful, heart-opening thing, taking us beyond the confines of our ego, even if only momentarily. But so often it is an area in which we experience an unhappiness and even abuse. Sex in itself is not something bad from a Buddhist perspective. So when we say, I purify my body, we don't mean that the body is somehow wrong or evil, you know, or that sex is somehow sanctified by marriage. What we're talking about is purifying our actions, so that we're not acting from a mindset rooted in hatred or craving, so we don't do harm to ourselves or others. So I think, you know, with the recent Me Too movement, we saw that pretty much every woman that we've ever met has experienced some form of sexual abuse. And obviously, you know, it happens to men and boys too. And the grosser forms of sexual misconduct include rape, coercion, sex with underage persons, sexual violence, pornography, and also infidelity. So anything that involves force or the power mode, the objectification of ourselves or others, and concealing the truth. So as a young woman, I worked as a glamour model from the ages of about 19 to 24, on and off, which essentially meant posing naked for male photographers, sometimes in underwear, and sometimes sort of worse stuff, which I won't go into because I don't want to trigger anyone's stuff. But I feel like I've seen firsthand how pornography objectifies women. And though my motivation for doing it was mostly extreme poverty, I also feel quite regretful now that I unwittingly contributed to perpetuating an idea of women as sex objects. Women, though, can also objectify men. Like, for example, in the romantic myth, where we expect a knight in shining armour or a prince charming, you know. To say nothing of those calendars with fire on them. So breaking this precept also includes infidelity, so lying to our partner. Breaking the truth, breaking someone's trust, is a kind of violence. And with infidelity, people often do find out, and a lot of pain is caused. It's also pretty hard to experience stillness and contentment when you're being unfaithful, because you spend so much time worrying about being found out. And just to add that it's not about the number of partners that we have, it's just about whether we're honest with them all. So is sexual desire an inherent breach of the precepts? Well, this precept isn't about celibacy as such. There is a celibacy precept that one can take, that I personally won't be taking it anytime soon. sexual desire is an expression of craving. And so, to be clear why some people might want to be celibate from a Buddhist point of view, I want to read you a bit of an extended quote, and it is quite long, from the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, but I think it's important. So it's based in Buddhist cosmology, but it all has psychological counterparts. So this is the quote. The plane of sensuous desire comprises, in ascending order, the hell world, the world of hungry ghosts, the world of asuras or anti-gods, the animal world, the human world, and the world of the lower gods, from the gods of the four directions of space up to the gods who control the creations of others. The plane of archetypal form comprises altogether 16 subplanes, from the heaven of the gods, belonging to the company of Brahma, up to and including the five pure abodes, which are inhabited by non-returners, those great spiritual beings who have developed transcendental insight to such an extent as to break the five fetters binding them to the plane of sensuous desire, so they will no more be reborn there. The third plane, the plane of no archetypal form, comprises four subplanes, all of which are inhabited by Brahmas, a class of spiritual being superior even to the gods. Much could be said about these three planes of conditioned existence. All that concerns us at the moment is the fact that on the planes of archetypal form, there is no such thing as sexual dimorphism, i.e. no separation into male and female. The inhabitants of these planes being what we would call, from the human point of view, androgynous. Sexual dimorphism, or separation into male and female, is found only on the plane of sensuous desire, including, of course, the human world. Since a state of sexual dimorphism is a state of polarization, tension and projection, it is also a state of discontent. In meditation, the state of sexual dimorphism is transcended. In meditation, one ceases for the time being to be either male or female. This is because in meditation, one progresses through the dhyanas, or states of higher consciousness. And these states of higher consciousness are the subjective psychological counterparts of the different subplanes of the planes of archetypal form and no archetypal form. While meditating, in the sense of actually experiencing the dhyanas, one is therefore a deva or brahma. In terms of the Western spiritual tradition, one is an angel and leading an angelic life. Angels, of course, by nature, are androgynous. It is thus no accident of language that the Sanskrit word for what we call celibacy, or more correctly, chastity, is brahmacharya, which literally means faring, practicing, or living like Brahma, i.e. not merely abstaining from sexual activity, but transcending the sexual dimorphism on which sexual activity and sexual desire are based. Okay, let's have a bit of tea. So, in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, it is wisdom which enables the letting go of a lesser happiness in pursuit of a happiness that is greater. Just to let you know, that I only know that quote because I've just done a reflection retreat with Ratnaguna. but I think it really fits this perfectly. So we don't give up things as a sort of act of self-denial. We give up things, we give up a lesser happiness for a happiness that is greater.
Do you repeat that again in the reading?
The reading from Dhammapada. Yeah, not the temple. Okay. It is wisdom which enables the letting go of a lesser happiness in pursuit of a happiness that is greater. Okay, so for those of us who aren't regularly sitting down to meditate and experiencing sort of radiant dhyanas, it's probably quite hard to imagine not wanting any kind of sexual activity, even just with ourselves. So we're going to need to practice the third precept, or in other words, we want to avoid expressing or experiencing our sexuality in a way that is harmful. So, with regard to celibacy or brahmacharya, if we're experiencing very refined states of consciousness, eventually craving will become something that we're no longer capable of experiencing. Because it's not just about transcending sexual dimorphism as such, it's about transcending duality altogether. So what do we mean by duality? So by duality we mean our unenlightened experience of the world, where we experience things in terms of an us sort of in here and an everything else sort of out there. In reality, no such distinction exists. In reality, there is interconnectedness or conditioned co-production. So to illustrate this, I always like to use the example of a rainbow. So if you have sun and rain, a rainbow arises. If one of those conditions changes, so the sun goes behind a cloud, then the rainbow ceases to be. So it's not that it was never real, just that it only existed in dependence on conditions. And everything has this same nature, including ourselves. If the idea of no self worries us, we can rest assured that we never had one to lose in the first place. So when we realise the real nature of reality, we no longer experience ourselves as separate. And so for craving to happen, there has to be two things. There has to be one thing wanting another thing. And to go beyond that is to go beyond needing to have sex, though I'm assuming you could still enjoy it in the same way you could still enjoy other things without needing them. So I'd like to move on to the romantic myth. Because the romantic myth is one of the most pervasive delusions around sexuality, and therefore one of the main causes of pain. So the romantic myth is based on the idea that we are somehow incomplete, that we will only find contentment when we find Mr., Mrs. or Ms. Right. And the romantic myth revolves around the experience of falling in love. So anyone who's been in love will know how incredibly blissful this experience is when reciprocated. And anyone who's been in love and it hasn't been reciprocated, so unrequited love, will know that it is one of the most painful experiences that you can have. People who are in love are in a similar state chemically to people who are high on class A drugs. They're high on their own brain chemistry. And even when it's mutual, it wears off at most. It lasts for 2 to 3 years. And if you're lucky, when it wears off, you will find before you your lover who is your good friend with whom you can do the stuff of life. And if you're less lucky, you will find this person before you and you will think, oh God, what have I done? Or in my case, you will think, oh God, what have I done again? because falling in love is actually projection. What Jung called projection. So projection is a state by which our unconscious or undeveloped qualities become conscious to us by seeing them reflected in another person. But the reason it's called projection and not reflection is that most often the person possesses that quality to which we are attracted in a much lesser degree than we actually possess ourselves. That is why we need to listen to our good friend, who kindly points out that that bloke at the Butterfield Festival in the frilly shirt isn't Poldark. He's just a bloke in a frilly shirt. But anyway, what happens is we see these qualities in another person and we feel a sense of wholeness, which is blissful, to begin with. So I'd just like to sort of say a bit about my own process around this. Actually, I was on this ethics retreat last year it was held in June. And there were all these poppies along the track, you know, the track into Tara Lake. There were all these poppies and other wildflowers, and there was this wheat field. And, you know, it was quite erotic. And I've been making these video diaries for the last few years, which I find to be a really helpful tool. And I've got this video diary from last year on the ethics retreat of me on that track over there. And I'm sort of going, oh God, I just want someone to ravish me in this wheat field. You know? it's just been years since I've had sex, you know. Happily, I started seeing someone about a month later. It's at a good old Butterfield Festival. So for the last year, I've been having this really beautiful connection with someone. But 3 years ago, I was really in quite a mess. So I fell in love with someone, and I fell in love with them really deeply. And we did have sex several times, but he didn't want to go out with me. And essentially, it plunged me into a sort of dark night of the soul. I hadn't been all that bothered about sex before I met him, and my life had been so full on for years. I'd been single for about 5 years, and you know, even before that, you know, I was so full on with my daughter that it kind of had stopped really kind of figuring in my mind, you know. But I remember this sort of actual moment when he sort of reached out and touched my face, and I just felt like I hadn't been touched for about a million years. And it was like that sort of kind of woman part in me just sort of woke up, you know, and I hadn't even realised that it was dead, you know. But he didn't want me. And the pain of sort of having been, you know, awoken by the handsome prince, but all he wanted was a bit of sex and he didn't want me. It was just so painful. And I really fell apart. And to say that I ached for him would be, you know, the understatement of the century, really. I felt like I'd fallen off the edge of the world. So I don't know how many of you have read the Philip Pullman books, his Dark Materials. Just read them all to my daughter. In those books, everyone has a kind of soul companion. It's a piece of their own soul in an animal form that goes everywhere with them. And there's this part in the book where the heroine Lyra is separated from her animal soul companion. And it says, "She felt as if her skin had turned into lace, and the damp and bitter air could flow in and out of her ribs, scaldingly cold over the raw wound where Pantaleimon had been." And that was how it felt. And I've had good friends die, you know, even to sort of suicide and overdose, and I've had far worse things happen in my life than just not being wanted by a man. But I had projected my soul onto him. And when I lost him, I felt like I lost my soul as well. I'm using this term soul poetically, of course. So later on in the Philip Pullman book, the witch Serafina tells how witches consciously undergo this being parted from their soul companion. They leave their soul companion behind and undergo the dark night of the soul. And when they are eventually reunited, they still form one whole being, yet each is free. And it's such a strong thing, this idea of sort of consciously undertaking to become free. Anyway, for me it wasn't a choice, and down into the abyss I went. And when you go down into the abyss, however it comes about, it's like you're stripped of all your gifts. All the mechanisms with which you previously used to survive seem to be taken from you. But you do not return empty-handed. You return with the treasure of the soul. And though my conscious experience was mostly painful for several years, in that time I grew so incredibly that I can no longer barely recognise myself. So just to add that these dark nights of the soul are triggered by all kinds of things, and sometimes there's no obvious trigger at all. And really all you can do in that process is to just let it take as long as it takes. I think that we can be quite hard on ourselves, especially as Buddhists, sort of trying to pull it all together, when actually what needs to happen is for it all to fall apart and reform in a new way. And I think we're quite uncomfortable in our culture with breakdowns or anything that looks a bit like mental health, you know, mental health issue. If we can look at it a bit more like a kind of shamanic dismemberment or an underworld journey, then I think we can give it the dignity that it deserves. So I developed the gifts of my soul while I was in the underworld. And in the underworld, I saw my wound. And my wound is that my father never loved me. He loved my sister, but not me. And eventually he abandoned us both. And how this has sort of played out in my life is that I fall for men who can't love me for whatever reason. And as a child, I hadn't been able to let myself see my father's failings. So he became this kind of godlike being for whom I would do anything just for a scrap of love. And I continue to act out this pattern through my life. So seeing this pattern clearly, I resolved to break it. And the man I'm seeing now is very different. You know, he's very gentle, very thoughtful, and he really takes care of me in the area of sexual expression. Because as well as the abuse that I've attracted from real existing men, my sort of low self-worth thing had become so ingrained that I couldn't have an orgasm unless I was kind of running a bit of an unhealthy sexual fantasy in my mind. So it is possible to break the third precept, even when we're having sex with ourselves. We need to be really aware of the kinds of fantasies we're having. Are they in line with the precepts? So I needed to mention that, because I'm sensing a bit of a lack of mention of female masturbation on Free Buddhist Audio. So yes, my lover helped me to stay in touch with my heart. So when we're in bed, he'll put his hand on my heart and say, "Are you in your heart?" You know, which I find really helpful. And if I'm not in my heart, then we stop. So what about stillness, simplicity and contentment more generally? So craving is essentially about wanting things to be other than they are. The antidote to craving is entering the present moment. When we enter the present moment, our storylines fall away. Stillness happens when we're not continually falling back into the past or flying off into the future. To enter the present moment is to be fully alive. And the tragedy is that we feel empty, you know, we feel separate, but we're not. Nothing is separate. Enlightenment is essentially the full realization of non-separation, and it is a state of boundless love. The kiss that truly awakes us from the sleep of forgetting is the Dharma. And the love that is in all things is the beloved. So, I don't know how many of you have seen The Truman Show. So I watched it again recently with my daughter. And The Truman Show is about this guy who's lived his whole life in a TV show. He lives in this gigantic sort of TV stage set, but he has no idea that it's not real. And everyone around him is an actor or an actress. But he begins to notice that things aren't right, and he decides to try to escape. But everyone around him is trying to entice him into staying. And in the end, they're sort of physically trying to prevent him from leaving. They're sort of like roadblocks and sort of cancelled flights and so on. And eventually he escapes in a little boat. Stop crying. It's really moving, that bit. He escapes in this little boat, even though he's terrified of water. And the sea in this is like part of the stage set too. So they're trying to sort of create these like gigantic waves, this massive storm to sort of stop him from leaving. But eventually, you know, after nearly drowning, he does escape. And our situation is not dissimilar. And we're surrounded by what is unreal and what propels us further into unreality. And it is not easy to break free. We're surrounded by collective delusions, the romantic myth, celebrity lifestyles, win £1 million on the lottery, buy your children loads of plastic crap so that they'll think you love them. You won't see many advertisements saying, you know, sort of stand still in silence, beholding the raindrops on a flower and feel totally satisfied. And it's not that the people around us are actors and actresses, but they are often suffering from unreality, the collective delusions, and they might be very resistant to us trying to break free, because it threatens their sense of reality. And the tragedy is that we continually search for happiness when happiness is the cessation of searching. Only when we enter the present moment do we become peaceful. Only when we enter the present moment do we feel whole. When we are at one with the moment, thinking disappears and the self only exists in thought. Relieved of the burden of selfing, we know peace, we know joy, and we know love. And this is the happiness that is greater. So anyway, I'm not enlightened, and I need to practice the precepts. And I'm really enjoying practicing the third precept. because I think it's a really strong practice. I was saying this to someone the other day. Recently, I was in bed with my lover, and the sun was shining in full through the window. And it was really exposing. And you know how bright the sun's been this summer. And, you know, I've just turned 50, and I knew that he could see, like, every single wrinkle that I had, you know. And I was just completely naked. And he was looking at me with so much love. And tears were just rolling down my face, you know, to feel so accepted and to be so myself. And I feel I know at last truly what it means to be a lover. So I'm going to end with two more poems. Well, one's a poem and the other is from Dennis Potter. So first of all, there's a poem by Marilyn Hacker. One morning you woke me, kissing my shoulders, as the rooster on the next block crowed. New light blued in the window full of plants, and the next door crash pad got Sergeant Pepper in the day's first groove. Dancing between moving limbs, the slow flowers of our friction opened together. So quickly you were salt and sweet on my tongue, like the desert we drove through, asleep on each other's shoulders. And this next quote is from Dennis Potter. So this is Dennis Potter when he was dying. There at this season, the blossom is out in full now, there in the west early. It's plum tree. It looks like apple blossom, but it's white. And looking at it, instead of saying, oh, that's nice blossom, last week looking at it through the window when I'm writing, I see it is the whitest, frothiest, blossomest blossom there ever could be. Things are both more trivial than they ever were, and more important than they ever were. And the difference between the trivial and the important doesn't seem to matter. But the nowness of everything is absolutely wondrous, and if people could see that, you know, there's no way of telling you. You have to experience it. But the glory of it, if you like the comfort of it, the reassurance. Not that I'm interested in reassuring people, bugger that. The fact is, if you see the present tense, boy do you see it, and boy can you celebrate it. Thank you.